He was staring up toward the North Star, but given how bright the moon was tonight, the star wasn't clearly visible. Kazuo held a crude lump of metal resembling a tin dessert box with a handle. It was an Ingram Mach-10 machine pistol. He said, "If the coin came up tails, I decided I'd take part in the game." As if he'd been anticipating these words, Mitsuru crashed forward. As he fell, his head hit the rock and bounced back up a few centimeters, then slumped to the earth. Kazuo Kiriyama sat still for a while. Then he got up and approached Mitsuru Numai's corpse. He gently touched the bullet-ridden body with his left hand, as if checking for something. This was no emotional response. He didn't feel anything, no guilt, no grief, no pity. Not a single emotion. He simply wanted to know how a human body reacted after it was shot. No, he merely thought, it might not be such a bad idea to know. He removed his hand and touched his left temple. To be more accurate, a little further behind his temple. Any stranger would have thought he was merely straightening out his hair, but that wasn't it. He did it because of a strange feeling he had. Not pain, not an itch, but something elusive and infrequent that occurred only a couple times a year. The reflex to touch the spot, along with the strange feeling, became quite familiar to Kazuo. Kazuo's parents had provided him with a special education, but in spite of learning what there was to know about the world at such a young age, Kazuo himself had no idea what caused this feeling. It was inevitable. Any trace of the damage had almost completely disappeared by the time he was old enough to recognize himself in the mirror. In other words, he knew nothing about what caused the strange feeling. Kazuo wasn't aware of the fact that he'd almost died from a freak accident when he was still inside his mother's womb, nor did he know that his mother was killed by the accident. Of course, Kazuo also didn't know about the conversation his father and a highly reputed doctor had had concerning the splinter digging into his skull right before his birth, nor the fact that neither his father nor the doctor, who boasted the operation was a success, knew that the splinter had gouged out a cluster of very fine nerve cells. Every one of these facts was from another time. The doctor died from liver failure, and his father, or more accurately, his real father, also died from complications caused by the accident. So there was no one left to share these facts with Kazuo. One thing was absolutely certain. It was a given for Kazuo. Although he might not have particularly realized it, or more appropriately, perhaps because he was incapable of coming to such a realization, this was what it came down to. Kazuo Kiriyama felt nothing. No guilt, no sorrow, and no pity toward the four corpses, including Mitsuru's. And ever since the day he was dropped into this world the way he was, he had never once felt a single emotion. 34 students remaining. Chapter 12. On the northern side of the island, opposite from where Kazuo stood amidst the bodies of his classmates, a steep cliff hung over the sea. It was over 20 meters high. On the cliff was a small field with a crown of wild grass. The waves crashed against the cliff and exploded into mist that drifted into the mild wind. Sakura Ogawa, female student number 4, and Kazuhiko Yamamoto, male student number 21, sat together at the edge of this cliff. Their legs hung over the edge. Sakura's right hand gently held Kazuhiko's left hand. Their day packs, bags, and compasses were scattered around them. Just as Kazuo had assigned the others to meet at the southern tip of the island, Sakura had scribbled, "At the northern tip," on the piece of paper, right after, "We will kill each other," she passed on to Kazuhiko. At least they were lucky enough to meet somewhere that didn't coincide with Kazuo's meeting place. Despite their circumstances, they were lucky enough to spend some time alone. There was a Colt 357 Magnum tucked into Kazuhiko's belt. but he already knew he wouldn't be using it. "It's quiet," Sakura murmured. Beneath her hair, which was cut short for a girl, her pretty profile, beginning with her wide forehead, seemed to form a smile. She was tall, so she looked slim, and she sat up straight, as always. Kazuhiko had only recently arrived. They hugged each other. Her body trembled slightly like a wounded little bird. "Yeah, it is," Kazuhiko said. Aside from the bridge of his nose, which was slightly wide, he was good-looking. He turned away from her to look at the view. The dark sea spread out under the moonlight. The black outlines of the islands scattered. And beyond them, there was land. The lights were shining brightly on the islands and what appeared to be the Honshu mainland in the distance. It was a little before 3:30 a.m. In between those lights floating in the dark, most people were sleeping peacefully. Or maybe there were kids like him studying late into the night for their high school entrance exams. It didn't look terribly far, but it was now a world beyond their reach. Kazuhiko confirmed the existence of the small black dot approximately 200 meters out at sea. It appeared to be one of the ships there to kill anyone attempting to escape by sea that Sakamochi had mentioned. Although the Sito Inland Sea was always busy with boat traffic, even at night, not a single ship passed by to send out its lights. The government prohibited all traffic here. It was chilling. Kazuhiko peeled his eyes from the black dot. He'd seen the corpses of Mayumi Tendo and Yoshio Akamatsu when he left the school. He also heard the sound of gunshots in the distance before he arrived here. The game had begun, and it would continue until the end. He and Sakura had already realized this, and this too no longer seemed to matter. "Thank you so much for this." Sakura was looking at the tiny bouquet of flowers in her left hand. On his way there, Kazuhiko had found several clover-like flowers, which he bundled together. At the top of the long, thin stems, the small petals were bunched together like a cheerleader's pom-poms. They weren't the most impressive set of flowers, but it was all he could find. Kazuhiko did his best to smile. "Oh, you're very welcome." Sakura looked down at the small bouquet, then finally said, "So we'll never be able to go home together. We won't be able to spend time together walking around town, eating ice cream, or doing anything else anymore." "Well," Sakura interrupted Kazuhiko, "it's futile to resist. I should know. I heard my father was against the government, and then one day..." Kazuhiko could tell from her hand that she was trembling. "The police came and killed my father. No warrant, nothing. They just came in without a word and shot him dead. I can still remember it clearly. We were in the kitchen. I was still small. I was sitting at the table. My mother held me tight. Then I grew up and ate my meals at the same table." Sakura turned to Kazuhiko. "It's no use resisting." It was the first time she had ever told him about her father's killing, even though they'd been going out for over 2 years. The first time they slept together, just a month ago at her house, she hadn't mentioned it. Kazuhiko felt there must be something else to say, but all he could muster up struck him as incredibly trite. "Wow, that must have been hard." But Sakura broke into a smile. "You're so kind, Kazuhiko. You're so kind. That's what I like about you." "I like you too. I love you so much." If he weren't so inarticulate, Kazuhiko could have said so much more. How much her expressions, her words, her gentle manner, her pure, untainted soul meant to him. How important, in short, her existence was to him. But he wasn't able to put it into words. He was only a third-year student in junior high, and worse yet, composition was one of his worst subjects. "Well," Sakura closed her eyes and took in a deep breath, as if a little relieved. Then she breathed out, "I really wanted to make sure I saw you. Then she went on. Horrible things are going to happen. No, they've already begun. Just yesterday we were all friends, and now we're going to kill each other. Putting this thought into words, she shivered again, and again Kazuhiko could tell from her hand. Sakura gave him a weary smile that betrayed her fear and the terrible irony of the fate awaiting them. I couldn't take that. Of course not. Sakura was kind. Kazuhiko didn't know anyone else kinder. Besides, Sakura spoke again, we can't go back together. Even if by some miracle one of us could go back, we still wouldn't be together. Even if I were to survive, I couldn't bear being without you. So, Sakura stopped. Kazuhiko understood what she was getting at. So I'm going to kill myself here, before anyone gets me, right in front of you. Instead of finishing what she had to say, she said, but you have to live. Kazuhiko smiled grimly, then squeezed her hand tightly and shook his head. No way. I'm with you. Even if I were to survive, I couldn't stand being without you. Don't leave me alone. Tears came streaming out of Sakura's eyes as she turned away from Kazuhiko. Wiping her eyes with her left hand, which was holding the bouquet of flowers, she suddenly blurted out, "Did you see the final episode of Tonight at the Same Place, which airs every Thursday night at 9?" Kazuhiko nodded. It was a love story broadcast by the National DBS Network and produced by the Republic of Greater East Asia Television Network. But it was quite good, topping TV ratings for the last several years. Yeah, I saw it. You wanted me to watch it. Yes, I did. So what I was thinking, as she spoke, Kazuhiko thought, this is exactly how we'd always talk. It was always about something really ordinary and meaningless, but blissful. Sakura wants us to stay this way forever. The thought suddenly made Kazuhiko want to cry. Well, I was all right about the two main characters ending up together. That's how it's supposed to be. But I don't know about Miki's friend Mizui, the one played by Anna Kitagawa. How could Mizui have given up on the guy she loved? I know I would have gone after him. Kazuhiko grinned. I knew you'd say that. Sakura laughed bashfully. I can't hide anything from you. Then she said happily, I still remember when we became classmates in junior high. You were tall and good-looking, sure. But the thing that really got me was how I thought, this guy would understand me. He would understand me down to the core of my heart. I don't know how to say this very well, but... Kazuhiko twisted his tongue a little and thought for a moment, then said, I think I felt the same way. He said it well. Then he leaned over a little, toward Sakura. With his left hand still clutching her right hand, he wrapped his other hand around her shoulder. They hugged in this position and kissed. Was it just a few seconds? Was it a minute? Or was it eternity? In any case, the kiss ended. They heard a rustling sound. They sensed someone in the bushes behind them. That was their signal. All aboard. The train is departing, so you better get on board. They had nothing left to say. They could have fought against the intruder. Kazuhiko could have taken his gun and aimed it at the person behind them. But Sakura wouldn't want that. What she wanted was to leave this world quietly before they got sucked into this horrible massacre. Nothing was more important to him than her. There was no room for compromise. If this were what her trembling soul wanted, then he would follow her. Had he been more eloquent, he might have described his feelings as something like, I'm going to die for her honor. Their two bodies danced in the air beyond the cliff, their hands still clasped together, the black sea under them. Yuki Utsumi, female student number 2, poked her head out from the bushes a little. She held her breath and watched them. She had no intention whatsoever of harming anyone, so she had no idea that the noise she made signaled their departure. She was simply stunned by the sight of the number one couple in class vanishing beyond the grassy cliff. The sound of waves quietly brushing up against the sheer rock face continued, and the small clover Sakura dropped remained lying on the grass. Even when Haruka Tanizawa, female student number 12, approached her from behind and asked, "What's wrong, Yuki?" Yuki just stood there trembling. 32 students remaining. Chapter 13. Megumi Ito, female student number 3, sat in the dark, hugging her knees and shaking. She was inside a house slightly removed from the island's most populated area on the eastern shore. The lights might have worked, but Megumi didn't dare try them. The moonlight coming through the window didn't reach under the kitchen table she was hiding under. It was almost pitch black, so she couldn't check her watch. But 2 hours had probably passed since she sat down here. It was probably almost 4 a.m. Had it been 1 hour since she heard that distant, faint sound that sounded like firecrackers? No. Megumi didn't even want to think about what that really was. She raised her face and saw, silhouetted against the moonlight, the cupboard and kettle right above the sink. She was aware the government probably relocated the island's residents to some temporary housing units, but the remaining traces of someone's life in this house was unnatural and creepy. It reminded her of the ghost story she'd heard as a child, about the ship Marie Celeste, whose entire crew suddenly vanished into thin air, leaving behind their plates of food mid-meal. She became even more terrified. She had run from the classroom with no idea where she was headed. Next thing she knew, she was in the middle of this residential area. The first thought that occurred to her was that there weren't too many students out yet. She was the 6th to leave the school. 5 were already out, but only 5. There were 50 or 60 houses in this area, so the chances of encountering one of them were close to nil. And as long as she locked the door and kept the place to herself, then she would be safe at least until she had to move. The collar would explode if she remained in one of the forbidden zones, but there was nothing she could do about it. Sakamochi had warned them that trying to pry the collar loose would set it off. The important thing was to make sure she could hear Sakamochi's announcement of the time and location of each forbidden zone. So Megumi had tried to enter a house, but the first one was locked. So was the second one. She went to the backyard of the third one and broke the sash window with a rock she found on the ground. It made such a huge sound that she ducked under the veranda. No one seemed to be in the area, though. She entered. There was no use locking the sash now. She had to laboriously close the storm door. Once it was shut, the inside turned pitch black, and she felt as if she'd wandered into a haunted house. She managed to pull out her flashlight, though, and searched the house. She took 2 fishing poles and used them to jam the storm door shut. And now she was under the kitchen table. Killing each other was out of the question. But what if this area, checking the map, she found the whole area was almost completely inside Sector H8, never turned into a forbidden zone. She might end up surviving. But Megumi continued shaking as she thought the situation through. That was terrible. Of course, according to the rules of the game, everyone was your enemy, so you couldn't trust anyone. But even if the game ended and she turned out to be the sole survivor, then that would also mean everyone else had died. Her friends, like Mizuo Inada and Kaori Minami, as well as Shuya Nanahara, who made her heart flutter every time she thought of him. What she really loved about Shuya was his voice, that slight rasp that was neither too high nor too low. He apparently loved censored music called rock, so he always looked really unhappy in music class when they had to sing songs praising the government and the dictator, but he sang incredibly well. The sound from his guitar when he played improvised passages was superb. The unfamiliar rhythms always made Megumi want to dance. And yet there was also something graceful about the sound, not unlike the sound of bells chiming in a beautiful church. And then there was Shuya's longish, permed hair. He once said, "I'm imitating Bruce Springsteen." But Megumi had no idea what he was talking about, not to mention his slightly drowsy-looking, kind eyes with double eyelids. Also, he moved with smooth finesse, as he'd been a star Little League player in elementary school. Her shaking subsided a little when she thought of Shuya's face and voice. Oh, if only Shuya Nanahara were with me right now. It would be so wonderful. So then, why didn't she ever tell Shuya how she felt about him? By love letter? Or by sending someone to bring him over, so she could confess to him directly? Or by phone? Now she'd never get the chance. That was when it occurred to her. The phone. That's right. Sakamochi said we wouldn't be able to use phones in the houses, but... Megumi grabbed her nylon bag, which was lying next to her supplied day pack. She pulled open the zipper and shoved aside her clothes and personal effects, grabbing her cell phone. Her mother bought it for her for this trip in case something, well, this wasn't just something, happened during her trip. It was true she'd been envious of the other one or two classmates who owned one, and there was something thrilling about the feeling of having your own private link. But Megumi also thought her parents were being overprotective and that her mother was neurotic. She'd wondered, why would a junior high school kid need this, when she put the shiny phone into her bag? She'd completely forgotten about it until this very moment. Megumi flipped open the phone with her trembling hands. The phone automatically switched from receive mode to send mode, and the small LCD panel and dial buttons lit up with a green glow. Her skirt and bags were now visible. But more importantly, there, without a doubt, was the antenna and reception bars lighting up on the display panel, indicating it was ready for a phone call. Oh, God! Megumi frantically pressed the dial buttons, the numbers for her home in Shiro-Iwa-cho, 08792. After a moment of silence, the phone on the other end began to ring in her ear, and her chest filled with hope. One, two, three rings. Please answer it. Dad, Mom, I might be calling at an unreasonable hour, but you must be aware your daughter is in an emergency situation. Hurry! The ringing was interrupted by a voice answering. Hello? Oh, Dad! In her cramped position, Megumi closed her eyes. She thought she would go crazy from relief. I'm going to be saved. Saved. Dad, it's me, Megumi. Oh, Dad, please help me. Please save me from here. She shouted into the phone in a frenzy, but she came to herself because there was no response. Something was wrong. What? Why won't Dad... No, this was... Finally, the voice at the other end spoke. I'm not your father, Megumi. This is Sakamochi. I told you the phones wouldn't work, Megumi. Megumi shrieked and tossed the phone to the floor. Then she hurriedly slammed the end button. Her heart thumped frantically. Once again, Megumi was overcome with despair. Oh, no. So I am going to die here. I'm going to die. But then Megumi's heart leapt right into her throat. It was a shattering sound. The sound of broken glass. Megumi turned toward the origin of the sound. It came from the sitting room, which she had checked to make sure it was locked. Someone was coming. Someone. Why, though? Of all the houses here, why this one? Megumi panicked and closed the cell phone panel, extinguishing the green glow. She put it in her pocket, took the weapon from her day pack, and pulled the double-bladed diver's knife from its plastic sheath. She gripped it tightly. She had to escape as quickly as possible, but her body was frozen and she couldn't move. Megumi slowed her breathing. Please, 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 God, make sure they can't hear my pounding heart. She heard the sound of a window opening, then closing. Then the sound of careful, quiet footsteps. They seemed to be moving around the house, but then they headed directly toward the kitchen and Megumi. A thin ray of light shot through the kitchen, gliding over the kettle and cupboard above the sink. Someone sighed with relief and said to herself, "Good, there's no one here." The footsteps entered the kitchen. As soon as Megumi heard the voice, though, Megumi was aghast. Any minuscule hope that she could work something out in case the intruder turned out to be a friend had been completely shattered. It was her. Mitsuko Sauma, female student number 11, the meanest girl in the entire school. Even though she had the loveliest, most angelic face, a single glance from her was enough to intimidate any teacher. Mitsuko Sauma was more frightening to Megumi than Kazuo Kiriyama, Shogo Kawada, or any of the other bad boys. It might have been because, like Megumi, Mitsuko Sauma was a girl. And also, yes, of course, because Megumi herself had been harassed by Hirono Shimizu, who was in Mitsuko's gang, when they first became classmates last year. If they were in the same hall, Hirono would trip her or slash her skirt with a razor. Lately, maybe because she'd simply lost interest in Megumi, Hirono had stopped harassing her. She was still disappointed, though, when she learned that her junior class was to have the same roster as her sophomore class. Mitsuko herself didn't pick on Megumi, but Mitsuko was someone even Hirono couldn't defy. Mitsuko Sama would relish killing someone like her. Megumi's body began trembling again. "Oh, please no, don't shake. If she hears me..." Megumi wrapped her body tightly with her arms to keep from shaking. From beneath the table, Megumi could see Mitsuko's hand holding a flashlight and the belt of her skirt glowing behind it. She heard Mitsuko rifling through the drawers near the sink. "Please hurry up and get out of here. If you could at least just get out of this room, then I could get to the bathroom. I could lock it from inside and escape through the windows. Please hurry." Bring. The electronic signal rang, and Megumi felt her heart leap out of her mouth. Mitsuko Sauma also seemed to quiver slightly. The beam from her flashlight suddenly disappeared along with the belt. She seemed to be approaching the corner of the room. Megumi realized the sound was coming from her pocket. She frantically pulled out her phone. Her mind went blank and she automatically flipped it open and randomly pressed the buttons. A voice leaked out. "Hey, it's Akamochi again. I just wanted to remind you, Megumi, to turn off your cell phone. Otherwise, if I call you like this, everyone will know where you are, right? So..." Megumi's fingers found the end button, cutting off Sakamochi's voice. The suffocating silence went on for a while. Then she heard Mitsuko's voice. "Megumi?" she asked. "Megumi? Is that you?" Mitsuko seemed to be in the corner of the dark kitchen. Megumi carefully placed her cell phone on the floor. The only thing in her hands now was her knife. Her hands were shaking even more, and the knife felt like a fish trying to wriggle free, but she gripped it as tight as she could. Mitsuko was taller than Megumi, but she couldn't have been much stronger. Mitsuko's weapon? Could it possibly be a gun? No. Then Mitsuko would have aimed it over here and fired. If Mitsuko didn't have a gun, then Megumi might have a chance. Yes, she had to kill. If she didn't kill, Mitsuko would surely kill her. She had to kill. There was a clicking sound, and once again the flashlight beam appeared. It lit up the bottom of the table, and Megumi squinted for an instant. Now was the time. All she had to do was get up and run toward the source of the light with her knife out. But Megumi's intentions were about to be abruptly undermined by an unexpected turn of events. The flashlight beam fell on a lower spot, and Mitsuko Sauma sank down on the floor into the light, staring at Megumi. Tears were streaming down Mitsuko's cheeks. "I'm so glad." Her quivering lips finally parted, and she managed to say in a feeble voice, I'm I'm so scared. Mitsuko's voice was frantic. She thrust both of her hands forward as if seeking Megumi's protection. She was unarmed. I can trust you, right? I can trust you. You wouldn't think of killing me, would you? You'll stay with me, won't you? Megumi was stunned. This was Mitsuko Sawamo crying. She's asking for my help. Oh. As the shaking in her body subsided, Megumi felt an indescribable emotion well up inside her. So that was how it was. It didn't matter how bad her reputation was. Mitsuko Sawamo was just another third-year junior high school student like her. Even Mitsuko Sawamo couldn't take part in something as horrible as killing other classmates. She was just lonely and scared out of her wits. And, oh, how terrible. I'd actually considered it. I thought of killing her. I'm so horrible. Megumi burst into tears, overwhelmed by self-loathing and the relief she now felt because she was no longer alone, because she was with someone. The knife slipped through Megumi's hands. She crawled on the floor, emerged from under the table, and held Mitsuko's offered hands. As if a dam inside her were bursting, she blurted out, "Mitsuko, Mitsuko." She knew she was shaking this time from a different kind of emotion. It didn't matter. "It's all right. I'll stay with you. We'll stay together." "Uh-huh." Mitsuko scrunched up her tear-stained face and squeezed Megumi's hands in return, nodding and repeating, "Uh-huh, uh-huh." Megumi held Mitsuko like this on the kitchen floor. She felt the warmth of Mitsuko's body, and she felt all the more guilty as her arms felt Mitsuko's body trembling helplessly. I was really thinking of doing something horrible. I was actually trying to kill this girl. "Hey," Megumi began to blurt out. I... "Hmm?" Mitsuko lifted her teary eyes up to Megumi. Megumi pursed her lips tightly to stifle a shriek and shook her head. I'm so ashamed of myself. For a moment, I was trying to kill you. I thought of killing you because I was so scared. Mitsuko's eyes widened when she heard this, but she didn't get upset. All she did was nod. Her face, which had been scrunched up from crying hysterically, now offered a warm smile. "That's okay, really. Don't get too upset. It's only to be expected in this awful situation. Really, don't get upset, okay? Just stay with me, please." After Mitsuko said this, she gently held Megumi's face with her left hand and pressed her left cheek against Megumi's cheek. Megumi could feel Mitsuko's tears. "Oh," Megumi thought, "I was so wrong about her." It turned out Mitsuko Sawamo was an incredibly kind girl. She managed to forgive someone who tried to kill her with such a kind response, saying, "It's okay. Didn't our teacher, Mr. Hayashida, who's already been killed, warn us how wrong it is to judge people just by their reputations?" With these thoughts, Megumi felt something well up inside her again. She held Mitsuko's body even more tightly. That was all she could do for now. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I am such a horrible person. I am really..." The slashing sound Megumi heard sounded like a lemon being cut. It was a nice sound. The knife must have been really sharp and the lemon fresh, the way they were on television cooking shows, as in, "Today we'll be cooking lemon salmon." It took her a few seconds to realize what had occurred. Megumi saw Mitsuko's right hand under her chin, and in it Mitsuko held a gently curved, banana-shaped blade that reflected dully against the flashlight beam. It was a sickle, the kind used to harvest rice. And now its tip was stuck in Megumi's throat. Her left hand clutching the back of Megumi's head, Mitsuko dug the sickle in further. It made another crunching noise. Megumi's throat began to burn, but it didn't last very long. She couldn't say a word and lost consciousness as her chest warmed over with blood. She expired, unable to form any idea of what it meant exactly to have a blade stuck in her throat. betrayed in the arms of Mitsuko, she died without any thoughts of Shuya Nanahara or of her family. Mitsuko let go of Megumi, who collapsed onto the floor right beside her. Mitsuko quickly turned off her flashlight and stood up. She wiped away the annoying tears, which she could produce any time. It was, in fact, one of her special talents. Holding the sickle in her right hand up to the moonlight, she whipped the blade, sending blood drops splattering against the floor. Not bad for starters, Mitsuko thought. She was hoping for a knife that was easier to use, but it turned out a sickle wasn't so bad. She hadn't been careful enough, though, in entering a house that might already be occupied. From now on, I'll have to be more careful. Looking down at Megumi's corpse, she spoke slowly and quietly. I'm sorry. I was also trying to kill you. Part 2. Middle Stage. 31 Students Remaining. Chapter 14. Their first night broke into a bright dawn. Shuya Nanahara looked up and watched the blue sky gradually turning white through the thicket. The branches and leaves of oak, camellia, some kind of cherry, and other kinds of trees wove an intricate net around them and hid them well. Shuya realized several things as he re-examined the map. The island was roughly diamond-shaped. The hills rose upward on the south and north end of the island. They were now located at the south side of the northern mountain, near the slope on its west side. According to the map coordinates, the location seemed to be in sector C4. Along with contour lines, the map was detailed, including the residential area and other houses, indicated by light blue dots. Various other buildings, there wasn't much besides symbols indicating a medical clinic, a fire station, and a lighthouse, and then a town hall, a fisherman's coop, and roads small and large, allowing him to check where each area was according to the positions of land formations, roads, and scattered houses. At night, as soon as they were higher up the hill, he had confirmed that the map faithfully represented this island. Silhouettes of islands, large and small, were scattered across the Black Sea, and as Sakamochi had said, there was, almost exactly west of the island, the silhouette of what appeared to be a guardship with its lights turned off. Immediately west of where Shuya and Noriko stood, the grove ended abruptly and was replaced by a steep slope. There was a small field below, and beyond it the slope continued on toward the ocean. A tiny shack with a raised floor sat in the middle of the field that they had passed through last night. Seeing the worn-out wooden Shinto archway 10 meters away from the shack, Shuya assumed it was a shrine, which was also marked on the map. The front door was open, and there was no one inside. Just as he had with the other houses, Shuya decided against hiding in this shrine. There might be others doing the same thing, and given how there was only one entrance, they'd be trapped the moment they were found. Shuya settled on a place surrounded by shrubbery relatively near the sea, where they could lie down and rest. Higher up the hill, the shrubbery seemed thicker, but he thought that would also attract others, and in case they met someone who turned out to be an enemy, he thought they were better off somewhere not too steep, where it would be easy to run. After all, Noriko's leg was injured. Shuya sat down against a tree that was approximately 10 centimeters wide. Noriko sat immediately to his left and leaned against the tree, her injured right leg limply stretched out. They were completely exhausted now. Noriko slowly closed her eyes. Shuya discussed their course of action with Noriko, but they couldn't come up with much. He first thought of finding a boat to escape from the island, but he immediately realized how futile that'd be. There was a guardship out at sea, and furthermore, Shuya slowly reached for his neck and touched the cold surface of that thing. He'd gotten used to the sensation, but it felt heavy, as if it were their inescapable fate itself, choking out their existence. Yes, the collar. Once a special signal was transmitted from the school, the bomb inside the collar would explode. According to the rules of the game, This would happen to anyone caught in a forbidden zone. But of course, the same would apply to anyone attempting to escape by sea. In fact, these collars rendered those guard ships unnecessary. Even if they managed to find a boat, it was impossible for them to escape as long as these collars were on their necks. The only way out was for them to attack Sakamochi at the school and disable the collar locks. But Sector G7, where the school was located, had been a forbidden zone since the game started, so it was impossible to approach it. Besides, their locations were constantly being monitored. He continued to think this through while the area was lit up by morning. It would be dangerous for them to move in the sunlight. He thought they should wait again for nightfall. But here again there was another problem. The time limit. If no one dies within 24 hours. The last time Shuya saw someone die was when he left the school, which was over 3 hours ago. If everyone remained alive for the rest of the day and night, in a little more than 20 hours, everyone would be dead. Even if they made an attempt to escape, by nightfall it might be too late to get their act together. Ironically, more classmates dying would buy the remaining students more time to survive. Shuya tried to shake this thought off. They were trapped. Shuya kept on wishing if only they could meet up with Shinji Mamura. With his wide range of knowledge and accompanying broad expertise to apply it, a guy like Shinji could come up with a solution to their situation. He still regretted not taking the risk of waiting for Shinji after Yoshiaka Matsu's attack. Did I really do the right thing? Would I have been attacked as an enemy there? Maybe Yoshiaka Matsu had been the only exception. No, that wasn't necessarily true. There might be a lot more enemies. It was impossible to determine who your enemy was in the first place. Who was still normal and who wasn't anymore? But maybe we're the ones who aren't being normal anymore. Maybe we're insane. He felt like he was going crazy. In the end, we have no choice but to sit here and see what'll happen. But will we come up with a solution? If that doesn't work, we can wait until night to look for Shinji Mamura. But will we even be able to do that? Even though the island was small, with a diameter of 6 kilometers, finding someone under these conditions wouldn't be easy. Besides, will we even have enough time between nightfall and the expiration time? Furthermore, let's assume by some stroke of luck, what an expression, we end up hooking up with Shinji, or it's just the two of us, and we somehow manage to escape. We would be considered fugitives. Unless we emigrate somewhere, we'll spend the rest of our lives as fugitives. And then one day we'll end up being assassinated by a government agent in some abandoned alley, leaving our bodies for the fat mice that come out and nibble at our fingers. In the end, you might be better off going crazy. Shuya thought of Yoshitoki Kuninobu. He was shaken by Yoshitoki's death, but maybe Yoshitoki was better off. At least he didn't have to experience this insanity. This situation that seemed absolutely hopeless. We might be better off committing suicide. Would Noriko agree to killing ourselves? Shuya glanced over at her and for the first time closely observed Noriko's profile in the peaceful dawn light. She had well-defined eyebrows, soft eyelashes framing her closed eyes, a cute nose with its flat tip, and full lips. She was a very pretty girl. He could see why Yoshitoki had a crush on her. Now there was sand stuck to her face, and the hair hanging slightly past her shoulders was tangled. And, of course, the collar. The gaudy silver collar wrapped around her neck as if she were a slave from ancient times. This damn game was taking away all her attractive qualities. Shuya then suddenly felt a surge of incredible anger. And with it, he came to his senses. We won't lose. We'll survive. Not only that, we'll fight back. It won't be some lame-ass counterpunch. They come with a straight right punch, and I'll wail on them with a baseball bat. Noriko opened her eyes. Their eyes met, and they stared at each other. Then Noriko quietly said, "What's wrong?" "Nothing. Well, I was thinking." Shuya was embarrassed because Noriko had caught him staring at her, so he just blurted out, "I know this sounds weird, but I just hope you're not thinking of committing suicide." Noriko looked down, her face ambiguous, forming what might have been a smile. Then she said, "No way. Although..." "Although what?" Noriko thought for a moment, then said, "I might want to commit suicide if we were the only ones left. Then at least you would be..." Astonished, Shuya shook his head. He shook it frantically. He had mentioned the idea randomly. He didn't expect her to respond like this. "Don't be absurd. Don't you even think of it. Look, you and me, we're together to the very end, no matter what. All right?" Noriko smiled a little, offered her right hand, and touched Shuya's left hand. "Thanks," she said. "Look, we're going to make it. Don't even think of dying." Noriko smiled a little again. Then she said, "You haven't given up then, Shuya?" Shuya nodded with some force. "Of course not." Noriko said, "I've always thought this, but you've always had this positive force."
"Positive force?"
Noriko smiled. "I don't know how to say this, but you have this positive attitude about living. Like right now, you're totally determined to live. And..." She still had a faint smile on her face as she looked directly at him. "That's what I really like about you." Shuya felt a tinge of embarrassment and replied, "That's because I'm an idiot." Then he said, "Even if we could escape, you know, I mean, it wouldn't matter to me because I don't have any parents. But you won't be able to see your mother or your father or your brother. Would you be all right with that?" Noriko smiled a little again. "I can deal with that. I made up my mind ever since this game began." She paused, then added, "What about you?"
"What do you mean?"
"You won't be able to see her anymore." Shuya hesitated. It was true. Noriko knew a lot about Shuya. As Noriko herself had said, "I've been watching you for so long now." He'd be lying if he said it didn't matter. He'd been so into Kazumi Shintani all this time. The thought of never seeing her again was... But Shuya shook his head. "It's not a big deal." He thought of adding, "It was just a one-way crush anyway." But he was interrupted by the sudden blare of Sakamochi's voice ringing through the air. 31 students remaining. Chapter 15.
"Good morning, everyone." It was Sakamochi's voice. The speakers were impossible to locate, but his voice came through loud and clear, aside from some metallic distortion. The speakers were probably installed not only in the school, but also all over the island. "This is your instructor, Sakamochi. It is now 6 a.m. How are you all doing?" Before he could grimace, Shuya's jaw dropped in astonishment at Sakamochi's cheerful tone. "Well then, I will now announce the names of your dead friends. First, Yoshio Akamatsu." Shuya's cheeks stiffened. Yes, it was another death, but the announcement of Yoshio's name also meant more to Shuya. Yoshio Akamatsu wasn't dead when Shuya left him. Then, was he killed in an attempt to kill someone else? Or, no. Did he remain unconscious, lying there, and then get blown to bits by his nice collar when the school became a forbidden zone? Regardless, the fact that Shuya had knocked him out didn't make him feel very good. That line of thought immediately evaporated with the announcement of other names of the dead. Next, number 9, Hiroshi Koranaga. Number 10, Ruhei Sasagawa. Number 17, Mitsuru Numai. Number 21, Kazuhiko Yamamoto. And then, let's see, the girls. Number 3, Megumi Ito. Number 4, Sakura Ogawa. Number 5, Izumi Kanai. Number 14, Mayumi Tendo. This list of names meant that their chances of survival were slightly increased, but this thought didn't even occur to Shuya. He felt dizzy. The faces of his dead classmates drifted through his head and disappeared. They were all killed, which meant that there were killers out there. Unless some of them had committed suicide. It was continuing. The game was undeniably in progress. A long funeral procession. A crowd of people wearing black. A man in a black suit with a somber, know-it-all face addressed them. "Oh, Shuya Nanahara and Noriko Nakagawa? You two, that's right. You're a little early. But you did just pass by your own graves right here. We carved in the number you two share, number 15. Don't worry, we're offering a special bonus." "Good going, everyone. I'm very impressed. Now then, the Forbidden Zones. I will announce their areas and times. Take out your maps and mark them." Still shocked by the number of dead classmates and angered by Sakamochi's tone of voice, Shuya nonetheless reluctantly pulled out his map. "First, an hour from now, at 7 a.m. in Sector J2. Get out of J2 by 7 a.m. Got that?" J2 was slightly to the west of the southern tip of the island. "Next, in 3 hours, F1 at 9 a.m. F1 was on the west shore of the island, but it was a remote area in the south. Next, 5 hours later, H8 at 11 a.m. Most of the residential area on the eastern shore was in H8. That's all for now. Now then, I want you all to do your best today." Shuya and Eriko's location wasn't in Sakamochi's forbidden zones. Sakamochi claimed the zones were randomly selected. In any case, they'd made the right move avoiding the residential area, but their location could be included in the next announcement. "Sakura and..." As Noriko spoke, Shuya turned to her. Sakura and Kazuhiko's names were mentioned.
"Yeah."
Shuya moaned deep down in his throat. "I wonder if they killed themselves." Noriko looked down at her feet. "I don't know. But they must have been together, knowing those two, until the very end. They somehow managed to meet each other." Shuya had seen Sakura pass a note to Kazuhiko. He and Noriko were only making hopeful observations, though. For all they knew, the two might have been killed separately, in separate places, by insane classmates. Dismissing the image of Sakura slipping the note to Kazuhiko as their hands touched, Shuya pulled out his student list from his pocket. It came with the map in the day pack. It was in bad taste, but he had to mark the information down. He took out his pen, and then as he was about to cross out the names, he decided not to. It was just too awful. Instead, he entered a small check mark by the names. He also included Yoshitoki Kuninobu and Fumio Fujiyoshi. Shuya felt like he was turning into the man in the black suit from the vision he just had. "Let's see, you, and also you, and you. What's your coffin size? It's a tight fit, but we can offer our popular number 8 model to you at a specially reduced price." Enough. In any case, 3 out of 4 of Kazuo Kuriyama's gang were dead. Hiroshi Koronaga, Ruhei Sasagawa, and Mitsuru Numai. The only ones who weren't mentioned were Sho Tsukioka, nicknamed Zuki. He was a little weird. And Kazuo Kuriyama himself. He recalled Mitsuru Numai's smug face when Kazuo Kuriyama left the classroom. Shuya had assumed Kazuo would organize his gang and attempt an escape. So what did these results mean? Maybe, even though they'd agreed to meet somewhere, they turned suspicious and turned against each other. Then Sho Tsukioka and Kazuo managed to escape. Would that mean Sho Tsukioka and Kazuo were still together? No. Something completely different might have happened. Shuya had no idea. Then he recalled the faint sound of guns going off. He'd only heard it once. If that had been gunfire, then which one of these 10 did it kill? His thoughts were interrupted all of a sudden by a rustling sound. Noriko's face stiffened. Shuya immediately stuck the pen and list into his pocket. Shuya listened closely. The sound continued. In fact, it was approaching them. He whispered to Noriko, "Be quiet." Shuya grabbed his day pack. They had to be able to move it any moment, so he'd put everything he needed in it. He'd left some of his clothes in his sports bag, but it wasn't a big deal to toss that. Noriko had also packed her bags the same way. He hoisted the two day packs on his left shoulder. He offered Noriko his hand to help her up. They waited in a crouched position. Shuya pulled out his knife. His right hand held it in a reverse grip. "I might know how to use a guitar pick," he thought, "but I don't know a thing about how to use this." The rustling became increasingly louder. It was probably only a few meters away. Shuya was overwhelmed by the same tension he felt outside the school. He held Noriko's shoulder with his left hand and pulled her back. He stood up and stepped back. The sooner the better. As soon as possible. They made their way through the bushes and came out onto a foot trail. It wound up a hill. Trees loomed above them, branches bunched together, and the sky was blue. Still holding Noriko, Shuya treaded backwards with her for several meters along the trail. The rustling sound continued in the bushes they just left. The sound grew, and then Shuya's eyes widened. A white cat jumped out of the bushes and landed on the trail. It was scraggly, and its fur was frayed, but in any case, that was what it was, a cat. Shuya and Noriko looked at each other. "It's a cat," she said, and broke into a smile. Shuya also grinned. Then the cat turned to them as if it had finally noticed them. It stared at them for a while and then ran up to them. Shuya returned his knife to the sheath while Noriko crouched, cautiously bent her injured leg, and offered her hands to the cat. The cat jumped into her hands and nuzzled her feet. Noriko slipped her hands under the cat's front feet and hugged it to her. "Poor kitty, look how thin it is," Noriko said as she pursed her lips at the cat as if to kiss it. The cat responded enthusiastically, purring and mewing. "It must be a domestic cat. It's so friendly." "I don't know." The government had relocated all the residents of this island for the sake of this game. Because the program was a secret operation until it was over, they must not have been informed. As Noriko said, maybe this cat had been owned by someone here and abandoned after its owner left. There weren't any houses in the area, so did it get lost in the hills? Shuya wondered as he casually looked away from Noriko. He turned, in shock. There was someone wearing a school coat 10 meters away, standing on the trail as if his feet were glued to it. Although he was of medium height, like Shuya, he had a solid build from his training on the handball team. His skin was tanned, and he had a buzz cut. His hair stood up at the front. It was Tatsumichi Oki, male student number 3. 31 students remaining. Chapter 16. Noriko followed Shuya's eyes and turned around. Her face suddenly grew tense. What was going on with Tatsumichi? Was he an enemy or not? Tatsumichi Oki stood there, staring at them. Shuya felt his field of vision grow narrow from the tension, the way it might in a speeding car. But in the corner of his eye he could still make out the large hatchet in Tatsumichi's right hand. Shuya reflexively raised his hand to the knife tucked in his belt. That set it off. Tatsumichi's hand, the one holding the hatchet, twitched, and then he began running toward them. Shuya shoved Noriko, who was still holding the cat, into the bushes. Tatsumichi was already right in front of him. Shuya quickly lifted up his day pack. The hatchet went right into it, splitting it open so its contents spilled to the ground. Water sprayed out of the bag from the broken water bottle. The blade reached Shuya's arm. A searing pain ran under his skin. He tossed down the torn day pack and leaped back to gain some distance. Tatsumichi's face was so wound up the whites of his eyes formed circles around his pupils. Shuya couldn't believe it. Yes, they were in a dire situation, and Shuya had been for a moment suspicious too. But how could he? How could that cheerful, nice guy Tatsumichi do such a thing? Tatsumichi